Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I am a PGY2 resident. This will be the 121st episode of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in this podcast, I'll be continuing my rapid review for the USMLE Step 2 CK exam. So let's begin. So what if you get a question about a patient that is a chronic alcoholic, and this patient has this patient is kind of like altered, his body temperature is like a 100.9, so kind of like a low-grade fever, and then they tell you that he's reporting some vague abdominal pain and his abdomen is mildly distended. What are you thinking about? I really hope you're thinking about SBP, right? So like spontaneous bacterial peritonitis, right? So what will be your next step in diagnosis, right? I would assume that you want to go ahead and perform a paracentesis, right? And after you perform a paracentesis, right, you basically count the number of white blood cells, right? If it's more than 250, that helps you make your diagnosis of SBP. Or alternatively, if you perform like a gram stain of that paracentesis fluid and you notice that you find actual bugs, again, that's positive for SBP, right? And obviously, if you want to treat SBP, you go ahead and give drugs that cover gram negatives, right? You go ahead and give drugs that cover gram negatives pretty well, right? So you'd potentially give a drug like ceftriaxone, for example, or you can give like a fluoroquinolone. And remember that if a person has SBP, you kind of need to prophylax them for the future, right, against future episodes of SBP, and you do that with a fluoroquinolone as well. And one kind of like sneaky way that your friends at the NBME can present SBP can be in a patient that's kind of like that has some kind of like instrumentation in their bowel, right? So it can be a person that is on like on dialysis, right? Remember, some people do like peritoneal dialysis. That's one way you can present. Another way this same phenomenon can also present is in a person that has like a VP shunt, right? So a ventriculoperitoneal shunt. So let's say a person that has like a history of like bad hydrocephalus or whatever, right? You can, that shunt, you go basically go from the brain to the peritoneal cavity, right? That can be another presentation of spontaneous bacterial peritonitis on NBME exams, and that's kind of something you want to keep at the back of your mind. Okay, now what if you get a question about a person that had an infection a few days ago, got a drug, and then now they're telling you that this person, their temperature is like 101.5. They have like a small rash on their face and on their trunk. And then they show you a CBC and you notice that the person's eosinophil count is quite elevated, right? What are you thinking about? I really hope you're thinking about AIN, right? AIN, right? So remember, AIN is basically the triad of fever, rash, and eosinophilia, right? So they'll have a high fever, they'll have a rash, and their eosinophils will be elevated either in the blood or in the urine or in both. Okay, those are high yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind. So what are kind of like some other things you want to keep at the back of your mind with eosinophilia? Because the thing is, eosinophilia is a very high yield thing you want to know for your NBME exams, right? So, I mean, I've said this ad nauseum in many podcasts, right? So, the mnemonic that I've kind of like curmudgeoned from like resources and all that stuff from all my taking exams over the years is DN quadruple ACP, right? So, DN quadruple ACP. So, the D stands for drugs, right? The N stands for neoplasms, right? So, like cancer. The first A stands for asthma, right? The other A stands for Addison's disease, right? And in terms of drugs, right, again, like it's like your classic like antibiotics, neoplasms, pretty much any neoplasm can cause eosinophilia, but classically on NBME exams it's the hematologic malignancies, especially like Hodgkin's lymphoma. The first A is asthma, right? Asthma, reactive airway disease. The second is Addison's disease, right? So if they give you an Addison's disease question, it'll be in a patient that has like hyperkalemia, hyponatremia, right? And the patient will like have like a relatively low blood pressure, and you'll have skin hyperpigmentation, right? And then acute interstitial nephritis is the next one, right? AIN, again, fever rash, eosinophilia or eosinophiluria or both, right? And then so asthma, allergies, acute interstitial nephritis, and Addison's disease. So I don't think I mentioned allergies. So allergy is the fourth A, right? And then the C is for collagen vascular disease, right? So any disease like scleroderma, like lupus, basically all those autoimmune things that you've learned about. And then the P is for parasites, right? Those things are all associated with eosinophilia. And I just said that in acute interstitial nephritis, if you take a look at the urine, you'd find elevated eosinophils. What if they give you an NBME question and in the urine they found white blood cell casts? What are you thinking about? I really hope you're thinking about pyelonephritis, right? These like urinary findings in select diseases are kind of high yield to know for exams. What if you see like pigmented epithelial casts or like the classically described muddy brown casts? What are you thinking about? That'll be ATN, right? Acute tubular necrosis. And remember that rhabdomyolysis, the kind of AKI it causes, is acute tubular necrosis. So like an intra-renal acute kidney injury. Okay. What if a person has like reddish urine and they tell you that the urine looks really red, that it's like positive for blood by urine dipstick, but when you spin it down and do the urine microscopy, you don't see any red blood cells. What are you thinking about? I hope you're thinking about rhabdomyolysis, right? Remember, rhabdo, that's the classic description. Positive for blood by dipstick, negative for cells by microscopy, right? Because remember, in rhabdo, it's the myoglobin that is essentially torching your kidneys, right? And again, remember, rhabdomyolysis is an example of acute tubular necrosis, okay? And remember, the things that will cause rhabdo on an NBME exam is a person that has some kind of risk factor that makes them obtunded, right? So they are alcoholics and they pass out. Or it's an old person, fell down and couldn't get up for a couple of hours. Or it could be a person that's a recent victim of like some kind of crush injury, right? That can also cause a rhabdomyolysis. And then also don't forget, if a person combines two drugs that are myotoxic, right? So if a person combines like a statin and a fibrate, right? So like a statin, like atorvastatin or pravastatin or rosuvastatin or simvastatin, and a fibrate like gemfibrozil or fenofibrate and stuff like that. And also remember, right, drugs like what is it called? A drug like daptomycin that covers MRSA. Remember, it's also myotoxic. Okay, so again, those are all high yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. Okay, now what if you find red blood cell casts in a person's urine? What are you thinking about? I hope you're thinking about glomerulonephritis, right? Some kind of nephritic syndrome, right? So like either like post-infectious glomerulonephritis or IgA nephropathy, right? Those are things you wanna, or even lupus nephritis, right? Those are things you wanna keep at the back of your mind. And then, what if you get a question about a person that has like fatty casts in their urine? Fatty casts in their urine. What are you thinking about there? Well, I hope you're thinking about again some kind of nephrotic syndrome, right? Remember, nephrotic syndrome classically they tend to have like 4+ proteinuria, or they have like the classically described 3.5 grams per day of protein, greater than 3.5 grams per day of protein in their urine, right? And again, they will have like the fatty, like the oval fatty casts in their urine. Remember, that can be either like minimal chain disease if it's a pediatric question dealing with nephrotic syndrome, especially after let's say they have like some kind of like hematologic malignancy, or it can be like FSGS. So for that, you want to think about a patient with a history of HIV, or a patient that is a drug user, like an IV drug user, or a patient that is African American, or a patient that is obese, right? You want to think about that, especially like the collapsing FSGS. That's the one that has the worst prognosis. And then if you're thinking about if they describe a person that has like some solid cancer, right? So let's say the person has like colon cancer, ovarian cancer, or whatever, and they have nephrotic syndrome, you certainly want to think about like membranous nephropathy, right? And then remember that diabetes can also cause a kind of nephrotic syndrome, right? It's just called diabetic nephropathy, with those classically observed Kimmel-Steel-Wilson nodules, right, on histology. And remember, the way you sort of like slow down their risk of like complete kidney failure is by giving some kind of ACE inhibitor, because remember, your ACE inhibitors sort of cause a, or they slow down an intraglomerular hypertension, right? Again, I've explained that mechanism in multiple podcasts, so that's something you want to keep at the back of your mind. Okay, so I think those are all the casts I specifically want to talk about. But again, those urinary findings in diseases. Oh, wait, I forgot one last one. So what if you they tell you, what if a person is dehydrated? What kind of cast would you observe in their urine? I hope you're telling me hyaline casts, right? Hyaline casts, those things are kind of made of like TamHOS4 protein. It just happens whenever you have like a person that is super dehydrated. Because think about it, if you're dehydrated, right, your afferent arterial will no longer be well perfused. And if your afferent arterial is not well perfused, well, the activity of your renin-angiotensin aldosterone system will increase. And when your renin-angiotensin aldosterone system activity increases, right, so one of the things, right, for example, like aldosterone, right, goes up, that reabsorbs sodium in the distal nephron, and water goes alongside, right? So urine becomes more concentrated. Also, ADH, remember, one of the jobs of angiotensin 2 is to go to the supraoptic nucleus of the hypothalamus, so that you release more ADH. When you release that ADH, that increases the reabsorption of water at the principal cell of the nephron, right? So your urine becomes more concentrated. Under those circumstances, if you look at those people's urine, you're gonna find hyaline casts. Okay, so that's something you want to keep at the back of your mind. Okay, now let's talk about some, I guess, presentations of back pain on NBMEs, because the NBMEs, they love questions about back pain, back pain, back pain, back pain, right? Okay, so what if they give you a question about a patient that has like low back pain, but in addition to that, they have they've kind of like lost sensation around their buttocks, and then they tell you that this person is having trouble having kids or maintaining an erection, like has erectile dysfunction. What are you thinking about? This is a classic surgery NBME question. What are you thinking about there? I hope you're thinking about Loeysche syndrome, right? It's basically peripheral arterial disease, but it's so bad that it does involve like the aorta, like the distal aorta and the iliac arteries. Okay, that's what's known as Loeysche syndrome, Lerische. Okay, it's like bad, bad, bad PAD that has involved distal aorta and the iliac arteries. And remember, what is the biggest risk factor for peripheral arterial disease on NBME exams? That will be smoking, right? Again, very high yield to know that. Okay, now what if they describe a person that was, lifting heavy boxes, and then they have like sudden onset severe back pain, and then they tell you that on physical exam you observe paravertebral muscle tenderness? What do they want you to go after there? I hope you're thinking about just some muscle strain, okay? And you don't need to do anything heroic, just NSAIDs, activity modification, right? Stuff like that. Okay. Now, what if they tell you that a person was, again, lifting heavy boxes, or let's say it's a person with osteoporosis, right? So maybe like a compression fracture kind of deal. And then they have low back pain, and they tell you that when you do a straight leg raise test, it is positive. What are you thinking about under those circumstances? I hope you're thinking about like a herniated disc, right? Like a herniated disc, right? So remember that in the part of the disc, right, that tends to herniate is the part that's known as the nucleus pulposus, right? So as it herniates, you can begin to impinge on nerves that are exiting the spinal cord, and the person will essentially have a radiculopathy, right? Remember in my neuro podcast, I was very careful in distinguishing between a myelopathy, a radiculopathy, a plexopathy, right? Those different things. Those are all kind of high yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind and be able to distinguish, oh, is this a problem at the level of the nerve, or a problem at a nerve root, or a problem at the spinal cord, or a problem at the neuromuscular junction, or a problem with muscle, or a cortical problem, or a subcortical problem, or brainstem problem, right? I know you may say divine, but these are all different levels of different things. Again, I promise you, especially if you're taking a neurology shelf, it's very high yield to know. If you're taking step 2 CK, it's one of those things they can test. That is one nice way they can test the neurology on step 2. So again, I will encourage you to go back and maybe listen to those neuro podcasts. Those are things that I feel strongly would help on an exam. Okay, and again, herniated disc, again, activity modification, rest, usually you recover within like 6-ish weeks, like you can take NSAIDs, but that doesn't mean that you should just rest at home for 6 weeks. No, that's not what that means. They rest for a while, activity modification and all that stuff, but yeah, they can resume like physical activity just with care, okay? Now, what if this back, you get this low back pain question, and it's kind of like a sudden onset severe back pain. Like it's something that started, notice that, just try and pay attention to this question. So it's like sudden onset, super severe, and it's a person that, how do I put this? So it's sudden onset, it's severe, it's a person that has, they tell you that, like they give you that this person's blood pressure is like 100 over 50, right? And this person is complaining of severe back pain, but they also complain of like severe abdominal pain. And let's assume this person is a big time smoker. What are you thinking about under those circumstances? What are you thinking about under those circumstances? Lower back pain, relatively low blood pressure, sudden onset, smoker, severe abdominal pain with that. What are you thinking about? I hope you're thinking about like a ruptured triple A, right? A ruptured abdominal aortic aneurysm, right? A ruptured triple A. Remember, many people are used to like, oh, hypotension, abdominal pain, pulsatile abdominal mass, and all that crap. The thing is, the MBM is beginning to steer away from those classic presentations of like a triple A that's about to rupture or has already ruptured, and they are beginning to go after the more exotic clinical presentations, right? Kind of like the low back pain, sudden onset, abdominal pain. In fact, sometimes they may ask, they may give you this classic presentation where they tell you that on imaging, the person has this thing known as the draped aorta sign, right? The draped aorta sign is just one of those things where it's like a classically described sign in radiology where you kind of see like some, almost like some calcifications in front of your vertebral bodies. It's just, remember, people that have a triple A, right, they tend to have like a calcified aorta, right? The problem there is that if that aorta ruptures, if it's like a contained rupture, like the posterior wall of the aorta, remember the aorta is like your descending aorta especially, is a retroperitoneal structure, kind of like your vertebral bodies. Your vertebral bodies are like in the posterior abdominal wall, right? So can you already envisage that if a triple A has ruptured or is about to rupture, the posterior wall of the aorta can sort of like just lie over the vertebral body? That's what creates the imaging finding known as the draped aorta sign, okay? That is classic for a ruptured or an almost ruptured or like a contained rupture of a triple A. Okay, so those are always a ruptured triple A can present, right? And again, hopefully you remember the screening guidelines for a triple A. I talk about it in my risk factors and a preventive medicine podcasts. Remember that the biggest risk factor for a triple A is smoking. Okay, so let's see, do I want to talk about one more thing? Okay, let's talk about some quick things with Let's see. Let's talk about some quick things with Pete, right? So, what if you get a question about a kid that is beginning to lose motor milestones, and they tell you that, let's say it's like a kid that's like 6 months old, beginning to lose motor milestones, and this kid, they tell you that he has like fasciculations on exam. What are you thinking about? That would be spinal muscular atrophy, right? Remember, if you have, I've mentioned this again in multiple podcasts, very high yield to know. If you see like a kid with fasciculations, and again, usually it's less than a year old, under those circumstances, you want to think about spinal muscular atrophy. If you see an adult, like an olderish person with muscle fasciculations, you want to think more about ALS, right? Amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, also known as a Lou Gehrig's disease. Okay, so so this kid has a SMA, right? Remember, it's an autosomal recessive disease, right? So believe it or not, they want you to still know these weird genetics things on step two, right? So it's an autosomal recessive disease. And remember that it tends to arise from mutations in chromosome 5, right? In like the SMN1 gene, right? So the survival motor neuron 1 gene. Okay, now what if they give you a question about a kid? Let's say it's like a 12-month-old, and they say that, you know, since he was born, especially since like 6 months of age, he's been having like, he has had like three bouts of like pneumococcal pneumonia or like pneumococcal sepsis, and he's had like gastroenteritis from like Giardia or whatever, and they tell you that some other members of his family, like his uncles or his dad or whatever, they've also had like multiple severe infections. In fact, like one or two of them have died from severe infections. What are you thinking about there? Again, in a kid, I hope with that you're thinking about some kind of B cell problem, right? Like Bruton's A gamma globulinemia. It's a really long name there. Bruton's A gamma globulinemia. I dare you to say that 10 times. Okay, back to this. So, Bruton's, right? Remember, it's an X-linked disorder, right? So, it should not show up in a girl on an MBME exam, right? It should not show up in a girl. It should show up more in a guy, right? And remember that it's basically a problem with like B cell like maturation. So those people will have like a lot of B cell or like antibody or like humoral immunity associated diseases, right? So primarily bacterial infections. The thing is on MBMEs, if you ever get a question that is an immunodeficiency question, you can usually finagle your way to the right answer by just sort of taking a look at what kind of bug pattern do you see in the question, right? So if you notice that the person is having a lot of like bacterial infections, you know it has to be a B cell problem, right? It has to be they may use different analogous words, B cell, antibody mediated immunity, humoral immunity defect or whatever, right? Those are all words used for that. But if it's a T cell problem, right, they will have like recurring viral infections or fungal infections, or they may have like pneumocystis jirovetsi. So like PCP, right? If you see any of those things, think more about like a T cell or a cell mediated immunity kind of problem. Okay, so that's what I so this kid has a Bruton's, right? And those kids will have like low levels of essentially every immunoglobulin, and really the way you treat that is almost like with like monthly injections of IVIG. Okay, again, that's high yield to know for exams. And if you notice, kids with Bruton's, right, their symptoms tend to crop up after the age of like 6 months, right? Because remember, they kind of have that protective IgG effect from mom. Remember, IgG is the only antibody that sort of crosses the placenta, right? So it sort of persists for a while. So it tends to protect those kids in that circumstance. Okay. Now, what if you get a question about a kid, you know, that has like, he's had like recurrent infections, and they tell you that he has like petechiae on his skin, and that he's had like some like bleeds when mom tries to brush his teeth, and then they tell you that he also has like a history of like eczema. What are you thinking about? I hope you're thinking about Wiskott-Aldrich syndrome, right? Wiskott-Aldrich syndrome. Remember, again, that's also an X-linked problem, right? It's also an immunodeficiency disease, and classically, right, those people tend to have like low platelets, right? So they have like a thrombocytopenia. That's what I'm describing, like the petechiae. And then they also tend to have like eczema, right? Eczema, that's something you want to keep at the back of your mind. Okay, now what if a kid has like recurrent like abscesses with like staph aureus? What is the disease you're thinking about? Again, I hope you're thinking about CGD, right? I hope you're thinking about CGD. CGD is like chronic granulomatous disease. Remember, that classically arises from a problem with NADPH oxidase, right? So if you have mutations in NADPH oxidase, you'll have a CGD. And basically, right, it's the thing that is kind of gets all screwed up, right, is like your oxidative burst mechanism, right? So since I assume it's a person that's taking step 2 CK that's listening to this, I would assume that you remember like this. I don't know if you remember, if you all remember from step 1, like this whole process of acute inflammation where you have like NADPH oxidase work. And then after that, you have like myeloperoxidase work and all that stuff, right? So if your oxidative burst doesn't happen, right, like in neutrophils, for example, you then begin to have problems with catalase positive organisms. And classically on NBMEs, it is staph aureus that they tend to go after. Okay. And then what if you get a question about a patient that has like an immunodeficiency disease? And they tell you that, oh, when this kid was born, this kid had seizures, right? And they tell you that, oh, that so this kid had seizures. This kid has been getting like recurrent, like this kid has had like recurrent parainfluenzal infections. And they tell you that when the kid had seizures when he was born, they got an EKG and they noticed that the QT interval was prolonged. What are you thinking about under those circumstances? That's the George syndrome, right? The George syndrome. Remember, the George syndrome, the third and fourth pharyngeal pouches do not develop, right? So those people's thymuses don't develop. Remember, that's where your T cells form. Those are where your T cells complete their growth. Everything ultimately starts in the bone marrow. But your T cells, they kind of like complete their puberty in the thymus, if you may, right? So those people's T cells don't work, basically. Right, so they have recurrent again viral and fungal infections or like PCP pneumonia, right? And then the reason they have that prolonged QT interval and seizures is from hypocalcemia, right? So remember, those people, right, their parathyroid glands, like their inferior parathyroid glands, do not develop, so they don't make PTH. If you don't make PTH, guess what? You're not going to be able to activate vitamin D or resorb bone, so your calcium will be low and your phosphate will be high, right? Because there's no more phosphate trashing hormone. Those people can have hypocalcemic seizures. And remember, hypocalcemia on an EKG can present as a prolonged QT interval. And it's actually kind of high yield to know that infants of diabetic moms also have hypocalcemic seizures. So if you see a baby that's like 10 pounds, 9 pounds or some crazy weight, and they have seizures after they're born, think about an infant of a diabetic mom. They either have those seizures from hypocalcemia or they have those seizures from hypoglycemia, right? From hypoglycemia. Because remember, in front of a diabetic mom in utero, he's seen high blood sugars coming down the pike from the placenta. But after in utero, right, the infant's blood is like, oh crap, there's too much glucose in blood, So the kid's pancreatic islet cells, right, beta cells in the islets of Langerhans, they make a crap ton of insulin to deal with that high sugar load. But when the kid gets born, right, that high sugar load is gone. But it's not like the pancreatic islets instantly shrivel down and stop secreting that much insulin. No, they still have like the hyperinsulinemia. And with that hyperinsulinemia, right, they can get hypoglycemia and get seizures. Okay, so that's another thing you want to keep at the back of your mind. And remember that infants of diabetic moms, they tend to have they can have like a hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, right? And they can have like a VSD on NBMEs. So those are things you want to keep at the back of your mind. Okay. And then the final thing I'll say is, right, and if you're again also thinking about like a neonatal seizure, or like a pediatric seizure, so not necessarily in a neonate, but if they give you a question about like a patient that was on desmopressin for like nocturnal enuresis, right, like a 6-year-old or whatever, think about a hyponatremic seizure, right? Remember, desmopressin is an ADH analog, right? So it can cause a hyponatremia. even the intranasal kind, believe it or not. Okay. Or if they describe a kid that has been like vomiting and all that crap, and then you've been giving the kid like just like distilled water, or like just straight up water, not like oral rehydration therapy, to sort of like replete the electrolytes, that can also again cause a hyponatremic seizure. Okay, so I think I'm gonna go ahead and stop there. Again, I've gone for like 30 minutes. This is supposed to be a rapid review. And again, as I usually do when I round up a podcast, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for the USMLE Step 1, Step 2 CK, Step 2 CS, and Step 3 exams, right? And I also offer tutoring for like the medicine, internal medicine in training exam, the ABIM or board exam, and also the like preclinical exams in med school and like the third year shelf exams. And then if you really have an acquaintance that is in college and needs tutoring for like physics, general chemistry, organic chemistry, physiology, histology, biochem, pretty much most of the stuff that's tested on the MCAT, you can have them reach out to me. And then if you're a med student applying to residency, so like an ERAS application, or a college student applying to med school, so like an AMCAS application, I do offer like one-on-one advising and consulting for that, like personal statements, interview prep, application prep, and all that stuff. So again, I've advised tons of people over the years, and many of those people have matched to their first choices. So take that for what you will. And again, I've also been on an admissions committee at a top two med school for like a year, right? So again, I have a lot of experience with these things. So feel free to reach out to me through the website or at Divine Intervention Podcasts with an S at the end at gmail.com. So have a wonderful day. I'll see you in the next podcast. God bless you. Thank you.